Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 574 for Wednesday, the 5th of September. My name is Len Padilla. I'm coming to you from Navarra in northern Spain. Once again, we had a weekend with no racing, so I called my good friend Matt Oxley to have a chat about the big picture in MotoGP racing. What's changing, what's not, and what it means for the future. Now, most of you will know who Matt is, and he won't need much of an introduction, but for those who don't, I'd suggest you just use your favorite search engine and look up Matt Oxley. Here's Matt. So, hey, Matt, how are things? How are you doing?
Pretty good, thanks, Len. How are you? Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's going all right. Missed the weekend of racing last weekend, but then I wasn't the only one.
No, we all missed it. It was a bit of a sorry weekend for MotoGP, but, a lot of angry people, all that really matters is we came out of there without anybody dead. You know, that's all that matters, basically.
Yeah, well, thankfully, we weren't too far away from that. So, yeah, like you say, we got lucky.
Yeah, exactly.
So, hey, I thought that sort of on the back of the conversation that I already had with Simon a while ago, that we would do something, well, similar but different, that we'd look at some of the big themes in MotoGP right now and how we think they might change the rest of the season, the coming seasons, and maybe further out if we decide to go crazy with it.
Sure. Far away, yeah.
So I think the first one, the interesting thing is, you know, the rider changes recently, you know, who's going where. Silly season is pretty much over. It was very early this year, but now it's quieted down. So what do you think are the big changes that we're seeing there, and how's that going to change, like we said, the rest of the season and maybe the next couple of years?
Well, I mean, the first thing, of course, is how weird the silly season was this year. You know, I mean, it was just very early and very silly. But yeah, I mean, obviously the big change is Lorenzo and Jorge Lorenzo going to Honda, and wow, and how that all kind of blindsided a lot of us. And I just think Jorge must have had such a laugh at Mugello because he must have signed by then. Well, from people I spoke to, he probably signed on the Thursday or Friday, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so he was carrying that secret with him all weekend while he was winning his first race for Ducati. And we were all going, oh, man, what's he going to do next year? And he's going to go to Yamaha. Will he have a ride? And blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly, bang.
yeah, big surprise.
And that was fantastic. I mean, he completely pulled the rug out from beneath everybody's feet. You know, I think there was one, I think, was it Meller? I can't remember. One of the Spanish journalists or one of the Italian journalists who got it right. I mean, I'm never very good at silly season stuff, really. It doesn't really bother me. You invest a long, 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 long time in finding out mostly just lies, you know. So yeah, it's not my deal, but I like to find out. So, I mean, wow, there's never been a team like that in MotoGP.
Yeah, it's a proper dream team.
And it's just going to be fascinating watching it pan out, you know, on the track, off the track, everything. I mean, these are two strong riders and strong characters. Yeah, I just think it's going to be wonderful watching it. You know, it's quite possible that Repsol Honda will win every race next year. And if they did, I don't think it'll be boring, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. You mentioned off the track, but do you really think there'll be much in it off the track? I mean, it might have been that way with Lorenzo and Mark 5 years ago, but do you think that's going to be the way it goes?
Oh, as soon as they're teammates, you know, they're going to be, there's going to be stuff going on. I mean, they've had their hard times, and I think now they're just, you know, huge amount of mutual respect. But when push comes to shove, it's going to get tasty, I think, you know, because Mark, he's got to protect his position, hasn't he, you know, and Jorge wants to come in and knock him down, and not literally, but he wants to kind of knock him off his perch. So that's a pretty interesting scenario straight there, you know, and that's the way it's going to be. And I, you know, I hope they do it well. There's no way it's just going to be all sweetness and light in that garage. Just no way, you know. And hopefully it'll be just really interesting watching them go about how they try to defeat each other, which is done on the track and off the track.
It will be interesting. Any other rider changes that you think are really setting us up for big changes?
Well, obviously, Juan Mir coming into Suzuki, you know, will that be a good move? I mean, Suzuki seem to have this big thing that they're, you know, they obviously signed Alex Rins when he was completely young and pretty unproven. He'd won a few Moto2 races, but, you know, he wasn't another Mark. Well, you know, this is the thing that everyone's looking for, the new Marquez, aren't they? You know, and so Suzuki signed Alex Rins, and he's good, you know, and he's going to get better. And they're jumping in, and they got Mir, who I thought Honda would sign. And I thought, why haven't Honda signed Mir? You know, and then bang, they've got Lorenzo. And you go, oh, that's why. There's this big thing. And the same with Yamaha getting Quartararo. He's won one Moto2 race. So all these factories are desperately, and obviously Yamaha are signed Quartararo through Petronas and, you know, hoping to bring him into the factory team in a few years. But there's all these factories desperately grabbing this young talent, hoping that they've got the next Marquez. And I don't, you know, with all due respect, I don't think Rins, Mir, or Quartararo are a new Marquez. You know, yeah. I mean, Marquez is a once every 20 years guy, as Rossi was.
Yeah, it almost feels like we're sort of at one extreme of a pendulum swinging. You know, we've got all of the factories almost playing the venture capital game, you know, throwing out all kinds of investments and hoping that 1 in 100 pay off.
Yeah. I guess it's, what would you call it? Well, it's short-term, long-term investments, I suppose, isn't it? And obviously Ducati is the complete opposite of that, because it's got two kind of old men almost, you know, Andrea Dovizioso and Danilo Petrucci next year. And by comparison, old men, you know, I think they'll do really well. I think Dovizioso, I think he was kind of early this season, he was messed up by the slight tiny change in rear tire. You know, the Michelin went slightly softer on the rear because they found their tires on the whole last year were a couple of clicks too hard. The hard tires weren't getting used much, so they went a bit softer. And that really did cause Dovizioso problems at the first few races. And I think it took him till about half season for him to and his crew chief to work out what to do. But, you know, he's coming strong again now. And I think Petrucci, you know, he's only ever a fraction off. And, you know, if you look at lap times, if you put him in a factory team and put all those extra resources behind him, you know, will it gain him a hundredth of a second? Will it gain, you know, he probably only needs about another tenth or so. You know, I hope they'll be really strong, because I think at the moment I would say that the Ducati is probably the best bike. They're all very, very similar. That's the thing.
Yeah, and it's an interesting contrast. I mean, you said that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's almost like the bike that's made the biggest leap, the Ducati, isn't even trying to make that leap with the riders. You know, they've got two good, solid, one almost might say journeyman riders on their bikes, while their bike has really made changes in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them journeyman, but I know what you mean. The thing is, in MotoGP now, unless you have got a Marquez or someone, that it's all about knowledge and intelligence. You know, you've obviously got to have the bravery, you've got to have the balls, you've got to have the willingness to fight, the willingness to just be 100% every weekend, never not even 99.5%. That can come from the older guys more than the younger guys. I mean, Dovizioso, he rides with his head. He always has. And he's just keep chipping away at it. And look where he is now. You know, he's, you know, and can a 19-year-old do that? You know, how long is it going to take? This is his ninth year in MotoGP. And the thing is that they're gaining knowledge all the time now. And MotoGP is a knowledge-based class. You know, you've got to really know your stuff. It's incredibly scientific. And it takes a while to kind of build up that depth of knowledge. And Dovizioso is absolutely the guy. You know, he's just chipped away at it. And he's had a factory ride, and they've chipped away at it. The Ducati's gone from the worst bike to the best bike, I think. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting contrast how they seem to have, you know, I guess they're putting Delinea putting his faith in R&D and riders that have got a lot of experience, you know, and who are clever. They're both, I mean, the thing about everyone in MotoGP now, they're very clever. I would say of the top guys, Andrea Iannone, you know, he's not as bright as some of the brightest guys. And I think that could be the problem. You know, I think it's all about being hyper, hyper intelligent, because there's so many pieces of the jigsaw to put together now.
Yeah. Well, that's the next rider I was actually going to ask you about. Do you think that, I mean, because we know that Andrea has speed on his day. You know, he's a brave one. When he was on the Suzuki and on the Ducati, you know, he really made it shine a couple of times. But going to Aprilia, you know, some might say it's a bit of a step back, where it was the only thing that he had left. Do you think that he can do anything to help them, and can they do anything to help him?
Well, I mean, Aprilia, I feel sorry for them, because, you know, they're the little guys, and they really are, you know, and they've had a horrible season. I've not spoken to Romano Albiasiano for a few races now, but they've obviously got a lot of things that aren't quite going right, and then Aleix Espargaró getting hurt and so on. How will Andrea Iannone go on it? I don't know. I mean, as you say, he's very fast, but now, especially with the Michelins, you know, it's up the kind of requirement for intelligence another few steps, and the electronics going backwards as well. You know, you've got to race with your head as much as your right wrist now. And I think Iannone is more of a right wrist man than a head man, you know. You know, if that doesn't sound too...
he won't hear this, don't worry.
dear. Yeah, so I'm not sure. You know, I think they've got quite a volatile garage there the next year, haven't they, with Iannone and Espargaró. I mean, I really like both of them. I think Espargaró is such a sweet guy, but he runs hot. And Iannone, I like him because he's this kind of wannabe gangster guy, and he runs hot as well. And, you know, is that a good recipe for success? I don't know. We'll see, won't we? But I mean, I do hope that Aprilia put their kind of technical problems behind them, because I think basically that bike's pretty good. But they've got just so, you know, half the resources of the bigger factories, you know, and that's difficult. That's difficult. That's a big gap to bridge, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, from running super hot to just a bit cooler, Johann Zarco is going to make a big, big change next year. From a satellite team, good team, but from a satellite team to a factory team on a not yet proven bike. What do you think that he's going to be able to do over at KTM?
That's the biggest question of all, isn't it, I think? I mean, you know, we know that Lorenzo is going to be fast on the Honda. We know that, you know, that Mir is going to be learning on the Suzuki. We kind of know where the Aprilia... Yeah, it's so hard to tell. I mean, you know, this is KTM's difficult second season, isn't it? The problem is when you're behind, if you're half a second behind everybody and you go off winter testing and you gain a half a second, you're like, woo, you know, we've got a half a second. Wow, we're really going places. And then you start the next year and the other guys have also got a half a second. So the guys at the front, they've got decades of experience and they just have to keep chipping away and putting that experience. The guys like KTM, you know, they don't have that. So however hard they try, even if they gain a half second every year, they're always in catch-up mode, you know. Yeah. But they've got a lot of money. They've got Red Bull behind them. And they're very, you know, they've never lost to anything. They really haven't. They've never lost to anything. So that, to me, is the huge question. How will Zarco get on with it? He's going from the Yamaha, which, as we all know, it might not be the best bike at the moment, but it's probably the friendliest. So how's he going to go? That, to me, is a huge question mark, and I really do not know the answer to it. And you know, he's kind of lost his mojo at the moment for whatever reasons, and you know, he needs to find that back, needs to get that back. But I think that's going to be great. I mean, I hope he does take him up another couple of steps, you know, because obviously, you know, they're so clever, Red Bull and KTM. They're just so clever at the way they put the pieces of the jigsaw into place, you know, with a young rider program and the way they've got engineers and the way they've got Hervé Poncheral's team, you know. So they've got 2 years experience in MotoGP. They've brought a team in that's got 20 years experience in MotoGP, and you just go, wow, you know, you guys are really clever. You know, I don't think most people understand how clever a move that was. They've just gained a whole couple of, you know, 20 years of experience just like that, bang.
Well, like you said, to be seen. A lot of work for them to do, a lot of work for everybody to do, and we'll see how that sets up the season next year. I thought maybe we could take a slight shift, maybe looking at things that that might change, not just MotoGP class, but, you know, World Championship Road Racing in the next couple to few years. I think we're just sort of starting to see the beginning of, I mean, one is probably a short-term change, but it changes something that's been going for a few years, which is new Moto2 bikes. So we've got a big change coming there. I don't expect that it's going to radically change the racing necessarily, just having a different manufacturer and a slightly different configuration of engine. But any thoughts from you on that, on having the new Triumph Triple with maybe different engine characteristics in the middleweight class?
Yeah, well, conveniently, I spoke to Alex Baumgartel, you know, the main designer at Kalex. Was it in Austria or the race before? I can't remember. But he's a super guy, Alex. Really, really nice. They dominate in Moto2 for a good reason. One of the reasons Suter kind of went backwards is they didn't really listen to their riders enough, and they were kind of giving their favored riders the best chassis and ignoring the kind of next step riders, and there was just not telling anybody what was going on, and that's why kind of everybody deserted them, really. And Calix look after their riders really well. They got a new chassis. I think the last new chassis update they had, I think it was in Germany, they gave it to their seven top riders straight away. Bang.
Right.
But anyway, we're talking about next year. So I was talking about this, and he says it's going to make a big difference. Obviously, there's not a big jump in power. You're probably going from about 125 to 135 horsepower. So that's not a big jump in power. But the big difference is torque, obviously. You know, you've got a 765cc three-cylinder against a 599cc four-cylinder. You know, you're going to have a lot more torque. And that's going to completely change the way you ride the bikes. Well, not completely change it, but it's going to change it. It's got to go even more to getting the bike stopped in the corner and then get it on and lift it up onto the fat part of the tire.
Right, right. So, more and more V-shaped corners.
Yeah, and much more towards MotoGP, because that's what MotoGP is all about now, especially with the Michelins and everything. You've got to get really wrench the bike up out the corner and get it up onto the fatter part of the tire. Because if the Michelin starts spinning on the edge of the tires, you can't stop them spinning. You're done. So I think that's a good thing, you know, that it's going to go more like MotoGP, and it'll probably be a bit faster, I suppose. Not that really matters really to me, but and also the electronics will change it as well slightly, which I know a lot of people will say, oh no, more electronics and so on, but they're very basic electronics that you can't really muck about with the mapping. You've just got a 16 step traction control and engine braking control, just the same as you have on a road bike now.
Yep.
Well, you might have, how many do you have on a road bike now? But so it's basically the same thing. But it's important that riders, because they currently go from Moto3, where there are limited electronics, traction control, which they use in the wet and so on, and then they go to Moto2 where there's nothing, and then they go to MotoGP where there's, you know, it's like NASA. So it makes a lot of sense to bring some electronics in there so that they don't go into MotoGP completely unaware of what's going on.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, like you said, how that serves as a better training ground for MotoGP and if it smooths out that that jump, because it is a big jump.
Yeah, I think it'll help from that point of view, and I think the racing will be, who knows? You know, I mean, I think Moto2's got a little bit, you know, it's strange, isn't it? Motorbike racing is such a strange thing. You know, you give the guys exactly the same engines. You give them no electronics. You give them the same tires. You give them the same everything, pretty much. And the chassis are pretty much the same. You know, barely any difference. You know, speaking to somebody that's ridden a Calix against a KTM, it slightly changes. You know, maybe the KTM, I think riders say that it's a bit more kind of consistent performance through a race, where the Calix might be better at the beginning or better at the end. But and the racing in Moto2 has become quite predictable. You know, mm-hmm. you remember the first year or two was just sensational, wasn't it? You know, but it's strange how despite that level playing field, that it's become quite drawn out as that kind of the riders and the know-how between the best teams just begins to kind of make itself felt, you know, and MotoGP is a lot closer than Moto2, you know, which is pretty weird.
Maybe the only thing that they need to do to make it a little bit closer is, you said the engines are identical, the chassis are nearly identical. I think they just need to throw all the keys into a helmet and have everyone pick one.
Yeah, like the old Yamaha Pro-Am thing.
Exactly.
Which I used to do, which was, yeah, literally throw the keys, ignition keys in the helmet and pick them out. The engine character might change that. You know, the fact that it's got more torque might make the bikes easier to ride, you know, and that will bunch the field up. The fact they've got a bit of traction control will make the bikes, you know, when I say easier to ride, people say, oh, that's rubbish because it's easier to ride if they've got traction control. It doesn't mean it's easier, as in basically means they will use that comfort zone to go another 2/10 faster, you know, so they will find it easier to go faster, but then they will be banging up against that limit straight away, you know. So, you know, all you do when you make a bike easier to ride is make it faster, basically.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I've seen this year, that we've all seen this year, that I think is going to have probably a longer term possible change is electric bikes. You know, we're starting to see at each round somebody or other takes the electric bike out for a ride, gives some guardedly optimistic comments about it. I wonder what that means for the future. I mean, some of us, Well, I'll admit there are a lot of people my age that get really wound up about electrics, that think it's the end, that you know, nothing's going to be as good as noisy exhaust on bikes. I'm not fussed. I'm looking forward to it. As soon as I can have an electric bike that weighs the same as my current track bike, I'm there. But I'd like to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I kind of think I share the same reservations, being a kind of having spent all of my adult life as a petrol head. Well, I wouldn't say a petrol head. I just like motorbikes, you know, and I like riding them at a reasonable speed. And I was kind of not too keen on the idea. So I thought, well, I need to ride an electric bike. So I borrowed a Zero a few months ago. And I live in London. And I didn't have time to go on any long rides, so I'm not going to talk about battery range and all that kind of stuff, because I know all that kind of stuff will come with time. The weight of the bike was heavy, but no heavier than the Tiger 800 I had a couple of years ago. The weight was a bit higher up, but, you know, no big deal. You get used to it. But, man, I just so enjoyed riding it around town. And, I mean, at the moment, that's, I think, where electric bikes are going to be, you know, they're going to be town bikes or commuter bikes. You know, you're not going to go touring on one. You're not going to, you know, go on a 200 mile, or maybe you are, but, you know, I think they're city bikes to start off with. That's what I think they are. And wow, just so much fun to ride in town, you know, because you have instant torque. You know, when you in town, you're doing a lot of direction changes, and you realize that you do so much subconsciously on a motorbike. You know, when you shut the throttle, the bike falls over, doesn't it? When you pick up the throttle, the bike picks itself up, and you don't realize when you're picking it back up that you are building that time delay into your riding. You know, you mm-hmm. know, you're opening the throttle before you need it to start picking up the bike to pick up, because you know it's going to take a while for the torque to come in and lift the bike up for you as you come out of a corner or out of changing direction. You do that on an electric bike, and the thing just picks up as soon as you touch the throttle, so you can be much more accurate just right. instantly. And I just found it so good for riding through traffic, and no gears, so it's like a scooter, and the lack of sound does not bother me. I just, you know, I had a very loud bike when I was 25 that made my ears pretty much bleed, and that was it for, you know, I'd done my loud noisy bike thing. I don't see the point anymore. So, you know, I'm all for it. I mean, I think that the electric, how will Moto E be? Well, I think you've got to look at it in the long term. You know, this is basically Dorna taking the first steps. And I would imagine they're doing it because if they didn't do it, somebody else would, you know. And they know, you know, like it or not, it is going to be the future or part of the future. So how it will be in the first few years, I don't know. But I think you've got to think, well, look, this is just baby steps next year. And these bikes are quite heavy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, it's going to be really interesting to watch, because you just don't know what's going to happen. My thought is not to expect too much and just be thinking, well, they've got to start somewhere. So they're going to start chipping away, and in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years' time, it'll be a multi-bike class, and it might get really interesting, you know.
Yep.
I think of the Star Wars kind of pod racing thing, you know, when they're racing, I don't know which movie it's in, you know.
Yeah, one of them. I remember.
To me, that's what electric racing has to be. You know, it has to be kind of these things with big sparks flying out of them, and they're roaring off at making crazy, weird noises. You know, if they were kind of doing that and looking and sounding quite scary, to me, that would be, because I guess that's what I want from a motorbike, from a racing bike. I want it to sound scary and to look scary when it roars off down the road. You know, I don't want it to look nice and safe, basically.
Right, you know? Right. Well, you mentioned the Moto E being, you know, being step one or even step zero. And I totally agree with that. I'm super looking forward to that next step. Like you said, when there are different manufacturers in there. And I almost wonder if they bring in some of that know-how that for now has been in the TT0, you know, because you've had the Mugen bikes that have been real strong there. I mean, you used to have some other bikes that were doing real well.
The Moto Sis.
The Moto Sis, yeah. And it doesn't seem to be terribly deep these days, but if you could channel all of that innovation in this new space into a place where they're going to get people looking at them, you know, arguably a whole lot more than at the TT. I think that's going to be great.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's worth making sure that everybody understands why they've gone for a single manufacturer at the moment. And that is mainly, There's a few reasons, but the main ones is because the sort of performance differences between the different brands, if you look at the electric TT, are enormous. You know, you'd have two bikes roaring off into the distance and the others like a minute behind at the end, or probably several getting lapped after five laps. It would be literally that bad.
Yeah.
So I think that's why they've gone for the one make, and also a cost thing, because basically they can say to Energica, you know, this is your gig, you're paying for it, and you're going to get a ton of publicity out of it. But, you know, the tipping point, obviously, will come when the manufacturers get involved, you know, and the Japanese aren't stupid, you know, they will know when the tipping point comes. You know, they're already, you know, Honda have got that little, is it PSX or something, scooter that they, I don't think you can get it in England yet, has got two batteries under the seat, and so you can swap them around.
Okay.
You know, so you know, they're getting there. Just without a doubt, there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes. And there's, at that point in 2, 3, 4, 5 years' time, when the Japanese manufacturers start making sports bikes with electric engines, bang, there you go.
Yeah, yeah, it will be good. It will be interesting. Like I said, I'm all for it. There are some things that keep me away from it for now, because I don't have a city bike. I don't need a city bike. I need something that's going to help me get around the track quickly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you do the track all the time, and I only do the road now. I rode around Silverstone a couple of months back on an R1 and was to do a story for a magazine with Neil McKenzie and his son Taron. And I haven't been on a track for a couple of years. I just lost interest, basically. I just think I'm going so slow, what's the point? And I was kind of missing my apexes by, you know, about 2 yards every time, and laughing at myself in my helmet. So, yeah, but I love riding on the road. I really do. I really enjoy riding on the road, and I try to be sensible, and that's part of the challenge, trying to stay alive, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good one there. Try to stay alive. So, looking out a little bit longer term, I know before we started recording, we were talking about, you know, what big global shifts are going on, and how might they affect racing, and without getting too doom and gloom, because, you know, that's easy to do, some of the lighter things that might happen. I mean, one of the things that we see happening, and I'll admit, worries me a little bit. If I lived in the U.S. still, I probably would have a different perspective. But, you know, 20 years here in Spain, I'm very much into how racing affects us here in Europe, and it seems like we're gonna have fewer races in Europe in the future, and there's not really a whole lot of way around that, is there?
You may well be right, but I think Dorna, you know, I think it took them a while to kind of work it out, but I think in general they do an incredibly good job now, and I'm not just saying that, I think they do. I mean, you look at MotoGP now, and it's never been in a better place, and how they kind of regained control of the rules from the factories was pretty spectacular. You know, I mean, to get a control software in there, how they did that, I have no idea. You know, because the Japanese factories, most of the Japanese factories really did not want to do it. So I'm very impressed by how they've kind of got control of the rulemaking. And that's why the racing's so good now. And it's the rules and Michelins, basically. That's the things that's making MotoGP so good now. So I hope that Dorna do nothing. I hope that they do absolutely nothing to the rules for the foreseeable future. And I think they know that they're in a kind of, they've got it right, and it doesn't need tinkering with anymore. Into the longer term with, yeah, where are we going to have races and so on? I think they probably look at F1 and they try to learn the good stuff from F1, and they try not to do the stupid stuff that F1 does. And I think F1 has got itself into a horrible hole for all kinds of reasons, and rules is one of them. Kind of taking the sport away from its natural heartland is another. You know, I think there's a price to pay for that. I mean, you could argue that Spain doesn't need 4 Grand Prix, but every one of them is very well attended, and they're great events, you know, so I don't hold a grudge against that. You know, all you want at a race is lots of people to be coming. You want a good track, and you want lots of fans having a good time, and that's all. And you good racing. So if we start going to all these places where there's not a lot of people around, or you're getting away from the, you know, the heartland of the sport, I think that would be a big mistake. But on the other hand, I think they need to go to Southeast Asia more. You know, we've got Malaysia, we've got Thailand. I don't really see why they're going to Finland. If we do go to Finland, I think, really, you know, I think there's better places to look at having races. You know, I think Southeast Asia, that's the only part in the part of the world where motorcycling is booming. You know, I mean, they are mad for it. So you've got to get there and really help that along. You know, and it's going to become increasingly Southeast Asian as a sport. You know, we've got riders coming in now. We've got the first kind of properly Southeast Asian team, Petronas Yamaha. Sports always change according to where the money's coming from. You know, when Norton was the biggest factory, you know, most of the riders were British.
Yeah.
You know, when you had to be a dirt tracker to ride a 500, most of the riders were American and Australian. And now that the sport's huge in Spain and Italy, most of the riders are Spanish and Italian, you know, and that's how the world works, you know. So because the sport is so huge and the industry is so huge in Southeast Asia, that will just keep happening. We'll see more and more people from those countries because they'll have good programs behind them, good sponsors, and they'll make it to the top. And I think that's great. I love it, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, that's the kind of change that I can get behind, seeing races in, whether it's, you know, well, Malaysia we already have, Indonesia, you know, places where there are people, where it's connected to the people that are interested in the sport. I'll admit, you know, I'd much rather see that than another Grand Prix in Qatar or Azerbaijan or wherever they do F1 races, you know, where they end up being little more than oligarch playthings.
Yeah. Or kleptocrat. Are we allowed to say that?
We just did.
I'll get, I'm in
You're fake
already.
News, so you can.
Yeah. I was only joking, everyone. I know what you mean. I agree exactly. You know, when you see Bernie Ecclestone sitting down to lunch with Putin, you know, I don't see Carmelo Ezpeleta sitting down to have dinner with Putin. You know, it's a people sport. I think that's what I've always loved about motorcycle racing. It's a people sport, you know, and it's classless. It's not like Formula One, which is very VIP, high-end, people going along to the races just because it's the place to be. They're not going because they love motorbikes. They're going along.
It could be Wimbledon or Henley or Ascot or F1.
Exactly. And that's why I love motorcycling, because it isn't like that. You know, it's a people sport. And, you know, but having said that, Bridgepoint owned Dorna. And at some point, they might sell Dorna and maybe some oligarch will buy it. And then God knows what will happen.
Yeah, well. We'll have to enjoy what we have and wait and see what comes.
Yeah, so I would say to people that criticize Dorna, you know, things can always get a lot worse than you think they already are, you know. And I think Dorna, the racing is brilliant at the moment. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And we've got amazing characters. We go to some great tracks. And, you know, I would just want to see it. I don't want to see anything change.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I wouldn't have said that 5 years ago when the 800s were whizzing around, because I really fell out of love with MotoGP for a few years then, where they were just going around, you know, first position 2 seconds, second position 2 seconds, third position 2 seconds, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that comes back to where we were with Moto2. You know, the reason that was like that was because there was no torque. You had to ride the bikes in a very, very special way with the 800s, and it didn't make for good racing.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the 800s, and that reminds me of something else we were talking about earlier, which was slowing the bikes down, because we know that right now the bikes are, they're damn near too fast for almost all the tracks we go to. And the only way around it is build more tracks in the desert where there are no people, or slow the bikes down. How do we make the sport sustainable in that sense without reproducing the disaster of the 800s?
Yeah, good, very good question. I mean, the 800s were obviously, you know, we were talking about Dorna taking back the control of the rules from the manufacturers. The 800s were the manufacturers sitting down and going, what we need to do is have 800s instead of 990s. So, you know, that's why it's good that the manufacturers don't write the rules. And I love seeing bikes do 220 miles an hour and, you know, going over the crest at Mugello and all that. And, you know, God bless Michele Pirro, and thank God he, you know, walked away from that and so on. But I know we are at the very limit. Every weekend you leave on a Sunday night saying a small thank you. I think a lot of people do not realize how close to the bone it is at the moment. And you got guys doing 220 miles an hour in packs of eight, separated by 2 seconds. You know, I mean, that is, you could almost say that it isn't sustainable. And the best tracks, the ones that I love, are the real old-fashioned big balls racetracks, Mugello, Phillip Island, Bruno, Silverstone. You know, and we're going to lose those tracks if we don't slow the bikes down. If we want to keep them, these bikes as we are, we can go to Valencia and just have a dozen races like Valencia, where there's no racing and they just ride around and it's all twiddly second gear corners and stuff. I'm not a fan of that kind of racetrack. So how do you slow the bikes down? Well, capacity doesn't work. We already know that. So what do you do? I guess, is it rev limits? Is it electronics? Another way of, you know, limiting them through the electronics? Do you limit them through the tires? You know, I think the tires is where you limit them. Corner speed is the problem at the moment. And it has been for years. You know, for some years, we've had bikes jumping the barriers. And once you reach that point, then, you know, you know you're going too fast around the corners. Because a lot of these tracks like Mugello, they can't move. You know, they can't afford to start digging away mountains, you know, to get to increase runoff. So the only way to slow down the bikes is tires, because if you slow them down through the corners, you slow them down on the straights as well. So, you know, bang, straight away, you've done it all. And by slowing them down through the corners, you're not only making these tracks like Mugello stay with us for the next decade or two decades, you're making it safer, because the corner speeds are, you know, riders are going to crash at lower speeds. They're not going to hit things. How do you do that? I don't know. Do you make the tires skinnier? I really don't know. I'm not a tire engineer. Do you just reduce the grip of the things?
So Pirellis and steel brakes. There you go.
I never said that. well, no, I think with Pirellis and steel brakes, they would probably be just about as fast. That's a weird thing. I mean, motorbikes are such weird things. They really are. And that's why they're wonderful. You know, you think, well, we'll do that. You know, it's like the 800s, you know, we'll do that and that'll make them slower. It didn't. They were straight away breaking lap records, you know, but the engines were like slightly lighter, and so they could use more corner speed. And because they used more corner speed, they had to use more corner speed because they had less torque. Then, you know, the lap times were the same, and actually going around corners faster. So, in fact, you could argue that they were more dangerous, you know. So motorbikes are very, very odd things. They really are. They really are. And it's hard to know. But I think basically the way to control motorsport is with grip. You know, that's the ultimate deciding factor in the performance of a car or a motorcycle. It's grip. You know, that's all that matters, basically.
I remember Dennis Noyes writing one time that the formula for good racing was very, very simple. You just needed more horsepower than traction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Although Moto 3, you know. yeah, absolutely. It's you know, I guess Michelin need to go away and start working on, you know, somehow producing a you know, whether you go for narrower rims, narrower tires, I don't know. But it's tricky because the riders are going to have to get used to going slower. If that comes at the cost of saving Mugello, Philip Island, Bruno Silverstone, to me, it's a, you know, if they're going to go 2 seconds a lap slower, who cares?
Yeah, you know? And I think that's the way that everybody can understand it. Like you said earlier, you can have the existing racing and accelerating racing and go to more tracks like Valencia, or slow it down and keep going to Phillip Island.
Exactly. And I know where I want to go, you know.
Yeah. So great. That was a great summary of the things that we've got coming up, short-term, medium-term, long-term. Anything else that you want to say to the Motopod listeners, Matt?
Thanks for listening, if you're still with us, if you still got this far. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the season. And, you know, it's a great shame that we lost Silverstone, because the Ducatis were very strong there. And Marquez is in a very interesting position at the moment. You know, he loves winning. He doesn't like losing. But he's in that situation where he almost kind of has to lose if he wants to keep, you know, stay in the lead of the world championship. You know, if he's not in a situation to win. We've seen him battling against kind of both Ducatis at the last two races and coming out second best. So, you know, the Ducatis are a long way behind, but it's not impossible. How many? 7 races left now? 59 points? It sounds a big gap, and it is, but it's by no means impossible. I mean, 7 races, what's that? 175 points, is that right?
Yeah, and when you think about it, that's one DNF for Mark and Jorge continuing to do really well.
Exactly. You know, and Jorge, wow, he's, you know, I mean, big respect to him, because he's turned that thing around and, you know, and then taking on a new challenge next year. I think kind of seeing Jorge in a bit of a new light at the moment. Yeah, he just seems like a kind of raging lion, just like, come on, you know, have a go if you think you're hard enough. And to kind of do what he did, go to Ducati and then say, right, I'm out of here, I'm going to Honda, is it's pretty spectacular, really. Yeah, like I say, I think it's just so bloody good at the moment, and long may it continue. that's all I can say, really.
Well, not much more to add to that. Matt Oxley, thanks very much.
Thanks, Len. Speak to you again soon.
Okay, talk to you soon. Super, super interesting chat there with Matt. Matt's on Twitter. You can keep up with him at Matt Oxley. You can find me on Twitter at MotoLen. You can always see what we're up to at Moto_pod. If you like what we're doing and you'd like to lend us a hand, go to our website, motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side, there are several ways that you can donate and keep the MotoPod wheels turning. Thanks again for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.